Hello, and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's discussion series, Today's Topics in Health Disparities. I'm Kara James, your moderator for today, and the Foundation's Senior Policy Analyst on Race, Ethnicity, and Healthcare. Today's topic in Health Disparities is a series of conversations that address issues relating to health and healthcare disparities in the U.S. The goal of the series is to raise the level of understanding of these disparities. Today's topic, State Initiatives to Reduce Racial and Ethnic Health Disparities, comes at a time when the latest National Healthcare Disparities Report found nearly 60% of disparities in quality of care between whites and racial and ethnic minority populations are either remaining the same or getting worse. It also comes at a time when 15 states have proposed or enacted major health reform, and 28 states, including the District of Columbia, are forecasting budget deficits in the coming fiscal year. Our conversation today will highlight some of the state efforts underway to address racial and ethnic disparities in health and healthcare. We will address some of the barriers to implementing these initiatives, how these initiatives fit in the larger health reform conversations, and how the federal government can help states. We welcome your questions, so feel free to email us at askkaisernetwork.org. Our panel today includes three distinguished guests whose bios are available on our website. In our studio, we have Cheryl Boyce, Executive Director of the Ohio Commission on Minority Health and Chair of the National Association of State Offices of Minority Health, Dr. Rhonda Meadows, Commissioner of the Georgia Department of Community Health, and Dr. Brian Smedley, Research Director and co-founder of the Opportunity Agenda. Thank you all for joining us. Brian, I'd like to start with you, and I'd like to ask you if you could talk to us a little bit about the distinction between health inequities and health disparities.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me, Carol. So language is important, as we know, in talking about health, and in particular talking about inequality in health between racial and ethnic groups. So we know that when we talk about disparities, and in focus group research, when we show people that disparities in health status exist, people tend to think that these are unfortunate, but they are, in fact, avoidable. So they think that they are due to either bad genes or bad behavior. We know from a large body of research in public health that this is an inadequate and only partial explanation of the problem. So when we talk about inequality in either health care or health status, what we're talking about are systemic conditions that are avoidable where inequality persists. And so that's why I use the term inequality increasingly as opposed to disparities, because we want to communicate that inequality exists and there is a moral imperative to address the problem.
You know, one of the concerns that I have, Brian, as people talk about inequality and inequity, is the fact that it's a systemic problem and that it may be possible to address inequity and inequality without addressing the issue of health disparities. And so I'm a little bit jaundiced because I wonder sometimes if we didn't do the smaller thing, disparity, what makes me believe that we're going to have the political will to do the larger thing and tackle an issue as large as inequity and inequality. So I'm really hopeful that as we move into the dialogue of health and inequities, that we are mindful of the fact that the outcome still has to be changing the health outcomes for significant groups of people in this country. And I really hope that we don't lose sight of that as we move toward this larger discussion.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add one thing? When we talk about equality in healthcare, we have to remember that sometimes the majority doesn't exactly have the best health either. So you may not want to be equal. You may want to all be better.
Mm-hmm. Interesting concept.
That's certainly true. One of the things that is important to point out about health care inequality is that health care quality problems are rampant throughout our health care systems. In many instances, white patients don't get the quality of care that would be recommended if we were following evidence-based guidelines. But the problem, of course, is that these problems are deeper and more persistent among communities of color. So one of the things that we want to suggest as a way of framing the issue to people is that health care inequality, if we can address this problem, then we are, in fact, dealing with some of the systemic issues that also can improve the quality of care for the majority population.
So we have received a lot of questions on this topic today, one of which was this conversation about sort of what are health inequities and how do they differ from health disparities. But I want to move us into that conversation on what are some of the state issues and things that are happening. So Dr. Meadows, could you talk to us a little bit about what's happening in the state of Georgia around disparities? I know you guys just released a large report on sort of health care down there. But
we released a large report on county-by-county level issues with healthcare disparities, but I kind of like to step back just for a minute because it isn't that we just came up with a report.
Right.
We had to actually basically reconstitute an advisory council that was made up of civic, healthcare, and community leaders across the state. Like a lot of states and like a lot of national efforts, the interest and the passion wasn't enough to sustain the actual resources to actually address healthcare disparities. Mm-hmm. So when I came on board as commissioner for Georgia's Department of Community Health, we only had, I think, four individual staff people to address what is a national, state, and regional issue. And then we hadn't had an advisory council actually reappointed since 2004. So the first thing we had to do was actually reestablish ourselves. And most states have had similar issues come up, particularly as administrations have changed, right, as leadership mm-hmm. has changed and moved on. Mm-hmm. So first we had to reestablish an advisory council. And this is probably the second point. The second point is that while the state may be leading the efforts in terms of doing a report and coming up with matching grants, the true leaders who are actually achieving the change to address health disparities were already out there in the community. They may have felt like they were siloed, or they may have felt like they were alone. They were certainly underfunded.
Right.
And they certainly did not have the resources that they need. And I think one person basically told me, you know, I feel like we are an army of the unpaid who are out here doing the job, fighting a battle on a regular basis. And we've been doing it so long without any resource that we've become an expert at doing everything with nothing. And I think that was very well put. When we came in, we basically tried to tap into the expertise, the energy, and the passion that was already out there. We brought them in as an advisory council. They came in to being officially December 2006, and then we asked them to give us the strategic plan. We as a state entity were not dictating what should be done because we believe, again, that the people already on the front line in the community have the answers, or have some of the answers, and have the knowledge base to actually get us going in the right direction. This group of advisory members, they were doctors, they were hospitals, they were dentists, but they were also educators, communication companies came on board, health plans, public health. We had people from all different walks within the community and healthcare industry who were leaders come on board. And they came up with basically what you would probably do, and what you probably have done, was identify is that first you needed to know what were the health disparities and have a common understanding of what does that mean and to what degree. And one of the first barriers they hit upon is, again, something that most of us have seen, and that was not having very specific data sets. We all know the horrible national statistics, right? Twice the mortality rate for our black babies, the higher mortality rate for heart disease for African Americans in general, higher rates of death from diabetes for Latinos. We know these already, but we didn't have very specific data. We had some general level for the state itself, but we wanted to bring this home into the communities for folks so they could actually see it and own it. So basically we did, we went down to the county level. Georgia has 159 counties. And I am amazed. I cannot claim credit for this, okay? These are people who are very smart. They tapped into as many different databases as they possibly can, everything from vital statistics to hospital discharge data, to everything you could possibly think of to come up with this county-by-county profile. And they address not just the usual healthcare indicators and benchmarks like emergency room use, access to hospitalizations. They looked at mortality rates from the different common basic diseases that we know affect populations, hypertension, diabetes, asthma. They also looked at income levels, employment levels, education levels, whether or not someone able to understand English, assuming that they spoke English or another language. And then they basically put together a profile for each county, and that, I think, is a much more wholesome way to look at it, because it's not just that people have higher death rates because they're just people and they're born from a certain genetic pool. They have higher disparities because of multiple issues hitting them at the same time. One of the other issues was the healthcare professionals in the area. Did they represent the population? Did they understand the population, and were they able to connect with the population? So they put together this report, and we released it fairly recently. We had lots of comments. We had some counties who were not particularly happy to have a grade. and then we had other counties who were actually more, a little bit shocked to see it quantified. They may not agree with it. Some of them do, but some of them don't. But if that's what it takes, they'll wake it up. To shake the pot a little bit, to get people engaged, then that's great. That's what we'll do. We have at this point 13 different town hall meetings in 13 different communities around the state of Georgia in which we will be shaking the pot a little bit, stirring it, getting people energized and galvanized. And then what we're going to do after that is actually provide them with some of the financial assistance to the best we can. We've pledged about $1 million in matching grants that will go to the communities who come in with their proposal, not our proposal, but what they see as what needs to be done. And they can choose their level of focus. Do you want to focus on the whole being, the whole person, which would be my preference as a family physician? Or do you already have something that's in play now that focuses on heart disease? And do you want to focus on that? Do you want to go from education to intervention to prevention? Do you want to do that? And if that's what they choose to do, as long as they've got a plan, they have a method of assessing what their baseline is today and then reassessing for improvement tomorrow, we're there for them. We're there to help fund that. I think they have the answers already.
So I want to come back a little bit more to this point later about some of the funding that you had on there, but you had mentioned you came from somewhere else, and I know that that happened to be the state of Florida. And can you contrast a little bit some of how Florida's situation differs from Georgia in terms of their ability to address disparities or some of the programs that were going on there?
Okay. I probably need to clarify that in the state of Florida, there was a Department of Health.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a department or the Agency for Healthcare Administration, and I ran the Agency for Healthcare Administration. So the Office of Minority Health is in the Department of Health for the state of Florida, and they have an Office of Minority Health. Now, what I'll tell you that I was engaged with in Florida is a little bit different in our approach. In Florida, I was responsible for Medicaid, for SCHIP, State Children's Health Insurance Program, and healthcare facility regulation, and quality provided by health plans. And if you just take all of that together and translate it, it means that I had contractual and regulatory authority to require people to do what was right. So it meant that I could build into contracts with health plans requirements to address healthcare disparities, to measure the clinical improvements that we needed to see, to show us some health outcomes. And we were able to do that through the Medicaid program, through the 12 HMOs that were in place. On the regulatory side for the healthcare facilities, we could actually encourage them strongly to work with us again on addressing cultural competency. How do you approach the patient? How are you doing with the follow-up? Are you understanding that perhaps you could use community health lay leaders to help you get the word out? We talked earlier about the role of prevention. It's not just a buzzword. It makes the most sense from a medical standpoint, from an economic standpoint, and from a health plan standpoint to do that, to put that energy and effort and investment in up front. You hear with the state of Georgia, I still am responsible for Medicaid and for SCHIP. I also have the state employee health benefit plan. So all the state employees, school teachers, et cetera. And again, I have contracts with health plans who are responsible for administering health care delivery. That means that I have the ability to say in my contracts, listen, 29% of the children in SCHIP are members of an ethnic or cultural minority. You cannot show me an improvement in the overall health of the children in SCHIP for the state of Georgia unless you address the health disparities that these children suffer.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it.
Right.
It's just impossible.
So, Cheryl, tell us a little bit about the setup in Ohio, and you're with the commission, and that's not in the Office of Health there, but what is your group doing, and how does that, help disparities there in the state of Ohio?
Well, I also want to thank you for allowing me to be here and to talk about the work of Ohio. We actually started in December of 1985 with the governor's executive order creating the Governor's Task Force on Black and Minority Health. It was during the same period of time that Margaret Heckler's Secretary's Task Force was operational. And then State Representative Ray Miller realized that if there was a problem nationally and there was a disparity, that Ohio probably didn't fare any better. And so 21 people were appointed. We had 12 months to quantify the problem. And like Dr. Meadows in Georgia, you know, a lot of the answers really lie in the expertise of the community. We decided oral storytelling was one of the shared strengths of the community. We engaged indigenous leaders in the Black, Hispanic, Native American, and Asian communities and set about going throughout the state and doing public hearings. Over 2,000 people came to the hearings and shared the experiences that they had. They also made recommendations, and one of the recommendations was that we have a freestanding state agency to look at issues of health disparity. I didn't think it was going to happen, but in July of 1987, we indeed became a freestanding state agency with a line item in the budget. We set about providing grant funds, and we had promised the community that we would engage them in all levels of decision making, and even today, 22 years later, people are involved in deciding where resources are going to be allocated. They're involved in the evaluation of projects. You know, often what the community sees as success is not what the system defines as success. And we wanted to make sure that we had input and involvement of communities. So we have provided grant funds over these 22 years to community-based organizations. We're looking for culturally competent, innovative programming that the system may not have funded. And as people show impact and the efficacy of models, then other people will embrace them and fund them. So we have projects that have been funded continuously since the early days of the commission who would not have had the opportunity. In recent years, we've looked more at capacity building and infrastructure. There has been an erosion of community-based organizations. And part of it isn't the practice in terms of the service, but the business practice. People get involved because of the passion of their heart. And so we've tried to provide more capacity building. So you will see things now coming out of Ohio like REAP, the Research Evaluation and Enhancement Project, a network of evaluators all over the state. We have worked in partnership with academic institutions to develop a state research agenda that also has community input. You will see things like local offices of minority health. We have now started funding offices in the largest cities in our state that can work with community groups, not compete against them, but work in harmony with them. We have an emergence of centers of health equity throughout the state, closing the health care gap in Cincinnati, centers at Metro in Cleveland and Cleveland State, and a new center being formed by The Ohio State University. When Governor Strickland came in, one of the things that impressed me very much about his administration is he brought together people from all of the service centers or departments in state government, and we forged a vision for what a healthy Ohio would look like. Our new director of health for the state, Dr. Alvin Jackson, has created a center for health equity within Healthy Ohio. And so we're now seeing not only the services being planned and presented in a different way, the services being evaluated in a different way, but an infrastructure being created in the state to support, maintain, and nurture the work that's going on. But I agree with Dr. Meadows, the community has to be intimately involved. They have many of the answers, and they need to be legitimized in terms of the import of the work that they do.
And I mean, one of the questions that we had is sort of to talk a little bit about sort of the increasing role on community health workers and their efforts around disparities. And so you've mentioned several programs and kind of taking it to the community in terms of efforts that you have going on there. And Brian, one of the things I was hoping that you could comment on a little bit, and you know, you released your recent report on sort of five states and comparing some of what they're doing is, you know, one of the big elephants that we have is Massachusetts, and everybody's sort of looking towards Massachusetts to see what they're doing, and they definitely put in some plans in place when they had their health reform around health disparities, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. Let me just step back a bit and say why we created this report. The first is that, obviously, health disparities and health care disparities and inequality in health care and health status are real. So these are problems that have been longstanding. They have existed for generations. But it is high time that we address them. Unfortunately, there's been a lack of effort at the federal level, despite the efforts of many in Congress, particularly the Congressional Black Caucus, Hispanic Caucus, and Asian Pacific caucuses, and many others to try to elevate the profile of health disparities. We haven't seen the action that is necessary at the federal level to address these problems. At the same time, of course, as you pointed out in your introduction, many states are looking at health care reform, significant legislation to address cost, quality, and expand coverage. This effort, this state health care report that we released through the Commonwealth Fund, is an effort to say that states necessarily can address disparities as part of this health care reform legislation. And there are many different ways to go about doing it. You've just heard about some of the innovative practices that are going on in other states. But as a legislative matter, what can states do to address disparities in the context of health care reform? So we identified a number of evidence-based practices, policies that states can adapt with, pertaining to things like access. And so the key message there is that in terms of, particularly for communities of color, providing an insurance card alone is not enough to ensure that people can get high-quality care in a timely manner that meets their needs. There are a number of other things that states can do to ensure access. These include enhancing the diversity of the provider workforce, improving cultural and linguistic competency in healthcare systems. States can also address quality as part of their efforts to enhance quality of healthcare in the state. But particularly for communities of color, we think that there are things that, that can be done, certainly in the context of quality improvement strategies or pay-for performance. We think that these quality improvement strategies need to have disparities, the reduction of disparities, as a key performance goal. So these are among the benchmarks that we offer in our report. Massachusetts is a very interesting example because a couple of years ago, as we all know, Massachusetts passed a very significant health care reform legislation that was many months and years in the creation. But Massachusetts is a good example of a state whose legislature saw that addressing disparities was an important part of that legislation. So as part of this law that's now being implemented, the legislation creates a Health Disparities Council, which is charged with addressing things like diversity in the healthcare workforce, making recommendations regarding appropriate cultural and linguistic practices, improving data collection. There's a provision in the bill to expand data collection so that we can better understand healthcare access and quality gaps, and importantly, data collection needs to include robust data collection around race, ethnicity, language, and socioeconomic status so that we can understand where and under what circumstances these disparities occur. So Massachusetts offers a number of provisions in this bill, particularly the Health Disparities Council, as well as other provisions, and certainly there's more that the legislature is considering. So there's also legislation that the legislature is considering now that would address a broader range of social and community-level determinants of health, which we think is very important.
Okay. So one of the things that has been common throughout everything that you guys have said is sort of data and the data collection so that we can know what the problem is, data collection so that we can know how we're doing in terms of tracking progress, and data collection in terms of changing demographics. And so, Dr. Meadows, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, you'd mentioned in the report that people kind of combed lots of data sources to get the data to report on what's happening in the counties. And one of the things, you know, what other data sources can you use, and what data needs do you have, and sort of where do you go from there?
I can probably talk about at a high level what it probably took to get just to what we've got today. It took actually all those people on the council actually remembering all the data sources that they had access to, but first setting out their list of questions. What do you want to know? If you think that these are the possible, you make your hypothesis and you say these are the 12 things that I really think impact, either cause, contribute to, or could help address health disparities, then they actually had to go to diverse sets of data sets. They did vital statistics from our Department of Human Resources. They got Medicaid data. They got SCHIP data. They got hospital facility data. They got adverse incidence reports. They got emergency room data. I mean, they literally had to go to different data resources in order to do that. And each one is a little tiny bit of a hurdle. to get that data sharing agreement, and then to decide whether or not the data that you've got is actually going to be helpful to you, it's going to be usable to you. And that's just the data sets that exist, right? And then you have to go to the data sets that exist not just in the state, but at a national level and see whether or not you can actually call down to Georgia, to regions in Georgia, on different issues and topics. And then you have to go to perhaps non-traditional healthcare data sets. And I'm sure, I think you're familiar with one, Dr. James, that would be the CAPS survey. Yes. Right?
Yes.
Well, you wouldn't normally think about that, or most people wouldn't think about that as being a resource when you're talking about health disparities, but that is an excellent resource to find out what did the patient think? Mm-hmm. What did they receive? Mm-hmm. How do they perceive their health? And that's one of the things that we've talked about with our health plan vendors. Guess what? We're thinking about beefing that up a little bit. We may ask you to really get down to the nitty-gritty. What language? How do they prefer to be communicated to? What is their perception of their health? You give me self-reported data about their behavioral changes. What did you ask about? Did you ask about this, and this? So there's lots of different sources that are out there, and some of it takes a little bit of out-of-the-box thinking about what you're going to use.
The approach you took makes so much sense, and so the question is, you used all those different data sets. How will you maintain those and kind of keep them talking to each other so that it still continues to benefit the community?
Remember those four little people that I said?
Yeah.
Now there's eight, and they're still overworked. And they literally we have to maintain our memorandums of understanding for data share on a yearly basis. And we have to continue to look at the data sets and figure out, did it really give us the answer that we needed? It's going to be a continuing issue of having dedicated resources to do that. And then I think we talked earlier about, well, how do we reach the changing population? Georgia is getting a larger and larger Mexican population, a larger immigrant population in general. I didn't even know we had a consulate for Brazil until recently. Apparently we do. And I said, how many people from Brazil are here in Georgia? Because I'm not really picturing 40,000. 40,000 people. I mean, that's a lot of people. So our whole population for the state of Georgia, both Metro Atlanta and the rest of Georgia, is changing on a regular basis. So we may have to change some of our data collection. Mm-hmm. Efforts and how we get to people.
We had, you know, several questions came in about data and, you know, the standardization of collection of data. And one of the things sort of in Boston that they've used is have come out with some guidelines on how data should be collected around race and language and education, because health literacy is so important and understanding that patients know what the doctor is saying and can understand that. And so one question to each of you sort of is, in your respective states and in the report that you did you find, are there standards for data collection that, you know, for the health plans that you've mentioned, this was also a question that came in, should health plans be doing, you know, what should we be doing with their data and how should they go about collecting it?
As unfortunate as it seems, I think the collection of data for these communities is an emerging practice. We have the advantage of working with a number of other states because of the National Association of State Offices of Minority Health. And this seems to be a national problem. While things aren't perfect at the federal level, people are still extracting federal data and then generalizing it and us making some assumptions. And so I think the fact that Georgia has actually taken the time and set up systems is a really, really needed practice for most states. I know in our state the health department is planning to create a new center for data. And so it's definitely on everybody's radar screen, but I don't think that we've arrived. It would also be nice to have some place that was a clearinghouse that the information in terms of the practice could be shared so that everybody doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. The face of this country is changing, and we didn't have a good handle on the data before. We're certainly nowhere near where we need to be at this point.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. I think there is a need for standardized data sets so that we can compare different regions, different states, different plans along the same set of metrics. Certainly, and as you point out, this is a new area. People are just now beginning to realize the importance of data. But there are resources. The Federal Office of Minority Health has a clearinghouse. And we can also build upon existing data sets, CAPS, HEDIS data, If we can disaggregate some of this information, or even hospital quality data along the lines of race, ethnicity, primary language, and socioeconomic status, then we'd be going a long way toward understanding when and under what circumstances inequality occurs, both in health care as well as in health status. And this is going to, importantly, point us to solutions.
So one last thing before we move to sort of a conversation about larger comprehensive efforts. You've mentioned some great initiatives and work that's happening in Georgia, and you've mentioned some in Ohio that are doing wonderful things, and you've got the Massachusetts and the larger ones. Is there a process by which we share this information across states, or are we all sort of operating in our own little bubble trying to do things?
Well, the state offices are trying at this point, and you may, you know, from the history of them, every state created an office based on the context of its own needs. And so we had people that were doing policy, and some people were doing service, and other people were doing funding. And we've now worked to create some core competencies that you would find in all states. And we have just recently opened an office here in D.C. We're a nonprofit organization. And part of the attempt is, you know, listening to the discussion of data and the changing faith, you know, these communities move and are very fluid, so people do secondary and tertiary migration. We're finding that people move across state lines as though they're not there. And so it really behooves us to have a network that's talking and working together. And while I don't think the state offices represent the panacea, it certainly is one really viable way of not only sharing some standardization of services while trying to meet communities' needs, but of sharing information and resources and building capacity that becomes a national capacity. At this point, there are 46 state offices of minority health, and so the reach is pretty extensive. All of them enjoy a very, very diverse dispersion of people throughout the states. And so the mobilization of communities becomes a reality and one of the assets that offices of minority health offer that I think make them unique in terms of their reach in these states. There's also at the University of Pittsburgh a repository finally for the historical context of what's going on. And so people, there's a frame of reference, and it's not, you know, I think about the fact that we're celebrating Minority Health Month in all of the states now, and that it looks like Negro Health Week that was celebrated in 1915, but somehow that got lost in history because there wasn't a repository of it. And so the resource center that OMH, the Office of Minority Health, runs, centers like the University of Pittsburgh offer us the promise of not forgetting history and being doomed to repeat some of these problems.
Mm-hmm. There's another benefit to the organization that you are now running.
I'm not running it.
Yeah. Okay, she will be. And that is the camaraderie. I cannot tell you how long I felt like I was in my own little silo working by myself. And then we would occasionally have an annual meeting where a bunch of people with like minds, like levels of passion and concern would get together, and I would have to depend on that one little meeting once a year to remind me and to energize me to go forward for the next year and cycle. So it's not just for capacity building and exchanging best practices, but also just to,
and you're right,
to, you know, have that strength,
to have the strength and to define the scope of practice. You know, we've talked about this becoming the emerging part of public health, that it's not just public health with melanin in it, mm-hmm. That there are things for us to learn and synergies and energies for us to share. And so I'm glad that you reminded me, because it, you know, as we've gone around the country doing the National Partnership for Action to End Health Disparities and the OMH initiative, they've been going from region to region, and they've invited people from communities and practitioners and academicians and tribal leaders. There were a lot of people from the Pacific Islands this past week when we were in Arizona, and people genuinely appreciated the opportunity to be in a room of people who were committed to this work, because sometimes I think being out there, you do feel alone, and that's really unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, so I talked about some of the larger issues that are going on as well, and we're not operating in sort of this bubble of just even doing the work on minority health, but in larger departments of health and in states. And so taking it up to that next level to look at some of the comprehensive health reform. And so I wanted to start with a little poll and to ask you, in the state of Georgia, is there sort of comprehensive state health reform that's being talked about or being proposed or anything like that?
There's not a comprehensive health care reform that addresses specifically health disparities yet.
Okay. And Cheryl, in the state of Ohio, do we have?
I believe that we're making progress. We have one of the Robert Wood Johnson initiatives, and a lot of people have been meeting. But again, going back to the governor bringing together everybody in the system to have a vision of what a healthy Ohio will look like. There are all of the words and intent in terms of health disparities. And so I feel promise and optimism probably for the first time in a long time that when people look at the impact, you know, we've talked about financial impact on cities when decisions are made. You know, when people make decisions, what will the health impact be? Finally, one of the criteria that people are talking about is how will it affect the health status of people and in communities of color. And so I believe that we are moving toward, and we've had lots of meetings and lots of discussions, but I see intent, and you know, and I think that it's really important that this is an intentional process and not something that just incidentally happens, that you try to do everybody and you hope that you get these communities. I feel that there is an intent to make a difference in these communities, and that it is being looked at in a much more comprehensive manner than we've ever looked at it before.
So what are some of the barriers to implementing comprehensive health reform and to even doing just the initiatives that you're trying to implement in your states?
I think one of the biggest problems is that people want to do different but want to operate in the same way. And so I think that there are times, and I don't think it's intentional, I think it's difficult for systems to change. We talk about embracing and involving communities, but that means sharing power with communities. And I think that sometimes that can be a disincentive. Certainly, lots of the states are going through budget challenges at this point, where really tough decisions are being made about who services will be maintained for and in which way. And it's hard to talk about reform and new initiatives when you're in a survival mode. And so the money right now is a real challenge. But I don't think that it should stop the movement, and it should not stop the intentionality of the effort.
Mm-hmm. I agree that the budget challenges are huge for many states. But I think at a fundamental level, for addressing health inequality, a big hurdle that we've got to overcome is a lack of awareness of the problem. We were talking earlier about how many policymakers still are not aware that racial and ethnic health inequality and health care inequality exists independently of income differences or health insurance differences. And so we really need to make this point very clearly that racial and ethnic health disparities exist independently of income differences, and that there's an important human and economic toll of this inequality. So there's an imperative to address this problem. We need to also make policymakers aware that addressing inequality is not a special interest. This is an interest of everyone in a community, be it a state, at the national level, at a county level. Addressing inequality ought to be a core goal, and of course is a core national goal, according to Healthy People 2010. But we need to make it key to any healthcare reform effort.
I was going to say, actually, you hit upon two key things for me. One is that not just an education and awareness, but an understanding and a belief that it is real. Mm-hmm. That's not someone's imagination. And like you said earlier, this is an avoidable mm-hmm. issue. But I'm going to kind of spin a little bit differently now, and this is the part where I'm getting a little bit controversial. You and I, we all understand the humanitarian reasons why people should have access to care, why health care should be distributed to individuals in an equitable manner. You understand the humanitarian reasons why you want to do the right and the just thing for people. Not everybody agrees or understands that. And sometimes you have to put things in a different language or from a different approach. And this is where we start tying it to economics. And not just the economics of health care costs that are going to accumulate from people not being treated at the right time because they're sicker, they're coming acutely ill, they have more costly care. Not just that,
But sometimes you have to walk up to individuals and say, let me explain something to you. This is not just an issue for the minority population to address. This is an issue you want to address together with us, because if this is not addressed in Georgia, 41% of the population is minority. 41%. That means that that's a workforce that's impacted by poor health care. That means that children in school who are missed school because of poor health care, and that means future workforce will be impacted. Productivity at work, missing work, absenteeism because you're either sick or because your kids are sick. And then there's so many different other reasons why, that if there are individuals who don't understand the humanitarian reason why, or just the justice reason why, sometimes you have to put it to them in terms of dollars and cents. And I find that when times come for budget crunches, that's what I usually end up having to do, is stand before budgeteers and explain to them the dollars and cents of addressing health disparities, resolving them on the front end, because you are only going to have to pay for it on the back end.
That's right.
And I think you're right. You know, one of the other barriers that we had talked about earlier, and I certainly want to mention it, is we keep talking about prevention, but we don't invest in prevention in this country. We want to do treatment. And one of the things I think I've heard in all of the states that we've visited, communities are saying, if you're so smart, you can treat disease, why can't you help us prevent disease? And so we talk about prevention for about 5 seconds, but what we're really talking about most of the time is treatment. And so I think that, you know, one of the barriers to this work is if we really believe in prevention, we should invest in prevention. And community groups seem to have a very good handle on things that they can do. But, you know, as you were talking about the people that make something out of nothing, I think we've all seen community groups that are doing this work that aren't being funded for it because there's no funding stream that supports it.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things, and one of the big predictors of healthcare equity and quality is access to care. And we have all mentioned the budget cuts and the budget issues. And so one of the questions that we have coming before us is sort of as we head into an economic downturn and the, you know, states are required to balance their budgets and the budget cuts that are going to be made, and particularly sort of we have this whole conversation on SCHIP and whether or not we're going to get children covered, and we saw what happened there. You know, what is the role of these programs and how are changes in these budgets going to affect both disparities and health equities?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I believe that if we believe that there is a different way to provide services, there must be a different way to support services. In our state, we've tried a number of different approaches. We have encouraged people to look at diversified funding. There are people, you know, so we definitely have people that do private funding, public funding. But we've also developed a product line out of the context of the services that have been funded. And that was a community-driven idea. Certainly wasn't anything that we thought about. Where people have developed what has become known as the Ohio product line, high-quality materials developed by communities that are made available to people in our state, but we sell them to other states. If people generate that money back into support services, they're allowed to keep the money in the community. And so social entrepreneurship has become a flash word. And that's kind of where we are with some of the services. Certainly doesn't mean that it doesn't create pain in the community. But we've really tried as an organization with a community-based board in state government to absorb as much as we can internally and not pass those reductions onto the community, but to talk to the community and work with them again from a business perspective, and in terms of visioning other ways of supporting, paying for, and having some control over what you do. Because, you know, one of the things that comes with taking public money is that in some ways, even though we try to be flexible, you have to do some things maybe in a way a community wouldn't want to do it. By encouraging communities to generate other revenue streams, it gives them more control over the way that they develop, plan, and implement services. But these are challenging times, and I don't want to minimize that. The budget reductions are real, and I think that they're going to be with us for a while, but it demands looking at this in a different way.
So kind of moving a little bit away from that and still sort of sticking to some extent with some of what the states are doing and the challenges that they're having, you know, what is the role that the federal government should play in all of this? You know, the question of the dollars and who should be paying for these efforts and how do you convince people, and I've got, you know, a triple-barreled question going here, so I'll start off and ask just one of these. Who should pay for these initiatives?
Well, obviously, what's happening with the current state budget crunch and the current discussions about the Medicaid and SCHIP issues are very, very much of concern for folks, because we're talking about folks potentially losing eligibility. We are trying to do a lot with a small amount of dollars. So, you know, I would say from the federal perspective, there are a couple things. One is to, as much as we possibly can, we cannot afford to lose kids, for example, out of eligibility for SCHIP. We can't afford to handcuff states that are attempting to do innovative work with SCHIP dollars to expand eligibility for enrollment. But we also, from the federal perspective, have to encourage state creativity. And I think this is there's bipartisan consensus that the federal government ought to support state innovation in healthcare reform. And I think there's a lot that states can consider with their particular population. But the first issue is, how do we limit the harm and damage that potentially can be done looking at the federal budget picture and the need for greater resources for Medicaid and SCHIP? One of the things that we know in terms of the Medicaid picture is that reimbursement rates continue to be so low that many providers are unwilling to accept Medicaid patients, which creates huge gaps in services, and I think is a very, very significant driver of the inadequate distribution of healthcare resources. So we know that when we have communities of color where you have a higher dependency on Medicaid and other public insurance programs, that you have fewer and fewer providers willing to work in those communities because the cost of services in many cases exceeds the reimbursement. So given that this is a very, very tight budget picture, I think we very much have to be concerned. And Dr. Meadows hit the nail right on the head that the economic argument is particularly important now, because we can either pay now or pay later. Right now, we're looking at potentially paying a lot more down the line for unmet health care needs.
I would say that we are already paying for this, not just in Medicaid. The federal government is the largest payer for health care. Medicaid, SCHIP, TRICARE, Medicare, I mean, you'd name it across the board. They're already the largest payer. Then each state has almost, 15 to 25%, depending on the range of their budget, is already health care. We are already paying it. We just need to be a little bit smarter on what it is that we're paying for.
And we want, you know, in the reform movement, it seems to me that we have been a lot more flexible about looking at service than looking at the reform of how it's going to be paid. With comorbidity being a real reality in so many communities, you know, we're beyond the day of people looking at single diseases and single funding for, yet we haven't figured out any new ways of taking that money and moving it around, allowing communities the flexibility that if they're crossing service lines, how can you take that money and leverage it, whether it's in the federal government or the private sector? And so I think that there are probably other ways to look at the payment mechanisms for services, but we haven't focused on those as much as we focused on some of the other things. I wanted to mention, too, you were talking about the goals for healthy people. You know, we set goals, but we don't do the other kinds of movement that needs to go with it. You know, setting a goal, a national goal, means nothing if the money doesn't follow it, all of the other support services that need to be there. And so we set these goals, but we don't change anything else in terms of trying to meet them. And I think that we just keep running around and around, and it has become frustrating. This issue is all of our issue. It's a state issue. It's a local issue. It's a private-public issue. It's a federal issue. And I would hope that as the states continue to do these innovative programs, that we start looking at different ways of moving the money to reward those that are doing well and find ways to incentivize other people or whatever we need to do. Having a goal on paper without the underpinnings just means that we got a goal on paper.
So one of the, you know, difficulties, again, sort of, and it all kind of comes down to the money again, but looking at piecemeal approaches first comprehensive approaches, and that's, you know, piecemeal approaches from let's target a disease to comprehensive approaches of let's do the prevention, let's look at the social determinants, let's look at the other pieces of it. And it's also piecemeal in these states that are tackling this one by one, first a comprehensive, let's all get together and kind of work this out. And so what are some of the benefits and the downsides to these particular types of piecemeal versus comprehensive at those two levels?
Yeah, I wonder sometimes if we didn't do the piecemeal stuff, would we ever get to the comprehensive stuff? I think that out of the context of the trial and errors, whether it's at the state level or the local level, certainly for us with offices of minority health, I'm not sure if we had not gone through the experiences that we've gone through that we'd have the vision that we have today that certainly is far more comprehensive in its focus. As I look, it seems like through history, a lot of the national things, a lot of the things we've embraced as good, actually came out of the piecemeal of those local state kind of initiatives, figuring out what works, why it works, finding those common grounds. You know, the community definitely, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of health disparity, is a common denominator in the solution. And it seems to be, you would hear that from every state. You would hear from the federal government, I'm sure. So once we get to that point, the question becomes, how do you take those piecemeal things that may have come out of the context of those states and formalize them and institutionalize them and allow them to create the same infrastructure to maintain, support, sustain, and nourish that the whole rest of the system has? If you look at health disparity initiatives right now, there are people that are doing magnificent work all over this country, but they are being done piecemeal. How do we create an umbilical cord, a system that will support and sustain them? And I think that that's the frontier that we stand at now. We know what works. We know who can participate. We have all that, but we don't have the funding base to support it. We don't have the infrastructure to support it. And I think that that's where we stand now in terms of putting together those things that support and sustain other systems. I don't think that anyone should expect the community to go on for forever underfunded, underappreciated, devalued, and not seen as a viable part of the continuum of solving this problem.
I would agree with that. I do think, though, that that a great deal of focus has been placed on addressing specific diseases, as you alluded to, and I think that one of the challenges from the standpoint of prevention and addressing upstream determinants is that the disease focus distracts our attention somewhat from the fundamental social and community determinants of health. In the year 2000, the Institute of Medicine released a report called Promoting Health, which argued that, to some extent, the federal research enterprise had, through its focus on specific diseases, as we see in the structure of the National Institutes of Health, had somewhat taken its eyes off the ball of those fundamental social and community level determinants that underlie many different diseases, whether you're talking about diabetes, hypertension, any number, cardiovascular disease. So just as an example, the fact that in many communities it is difficult, if not impossible, to get fresh, high quality fruits and vegetables in the neighborhood, which can lead to a whole host of problems related to diet and nutrition. We see the disease outcomes in hypertension, cardiovascular disease, a range of other health outcomes, but it's that fundamental issue that we sometimes lose focus of when we have a disease-specific orientation.
And that's also a point of disconnect. Have you ever heard of someone getting a patient getting information about what diet they're supposed to eat, and they're getting this list, and it's got Brussels sprouts on it, and there's no Brussels sprout within 50 miles of where they live? That they're like, I don't know what that's supposed to be, but I don't have it, and I'm not going to get it. And they go back to what it is that they know and what's easily accessible to them. I mean, so it's can't just have the ideal.
That's right.
It has to be real.
That's right.
And I would really hope that someday the federal government and private funders, and I'm sure that people talk as funders, but would all come together, because if this is going to be a comprehensive approach, it means that it probably could be a shared resource pool that would allow for funding in a different way, to support activity in a different way, that would yield a different outcome.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask a difficult question. Brian, in your report, you said that access to care and coverage is necessary but not sufficient to dealing with health inequities. And in my introduction, I had mentioned that we have about 15 states who've enacted or proposed large health reform. What do you say to those other states where that hasn't happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly the question of whether a state legislature is willing to consider and tackle the tough issues around comprehensive health reform, certainly there are a lot of undercurrents behind that. What we're arguing in this report is that certainly there's a lot that states can do to improve the cost, quality, and coverage. We're agnostic on how states go about doing that. But it's important to recognize that for many states, as has been pointed out, when we look at the demographic shifts, we're not talking about, when we're talking about inequality, we're not talking about a problem that affects only those folks over there. We are all together in this. And so when we look at the fact that by mid-century, nearly one in two people in the United States is going to be a person of color, we realize that health inequality is a problem that we've got to tackle at many levels. As I mentioned earlier, we think that there certainly could be more federal effort in this area. And in the absence of that, we're looking to states as the engines of change and engines of healthcare reform. And we think that inequality ought to be addressed front and center. So when we say that providing coverage is necessary but not sufficient, what we mean is that universal coverage is critically important to achieve equity in health and healthcare. But we've got to go beyond that to ensure that all communities have an opportunity for good health.
Mm-hmm. And very quickly, sort of as a last question, we've talked about comprehensive health reform and sort of health disparities, as health inequities as a way of dealing with this issue. And I'm sure many people out there have the question of, where do you begin? So to the, you know, what would your advice be to the listeners out there from all the various states who are trying to deal with this issue? Where do you start?
One of the places I would suggest people start is with the National Association of State Offices of Minority Health. Although it's a membership organization for states, it certainly is there as a resource to everyone else. The office is located here in Washington at 1776 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest. We have, through an arrangement with the Office of Minority Health, published profiles for every state. So anyone in any the 46 states that have offices of minority health, it will serve as a really pretty comprehensive overview of activities within the state, where those services are, where resources are within the states. I know that ASC, though, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officers, has also done profiles for the states. And so in terms of someone accessing information with a click of a switch to go to a website, it would be a really good way to get an overview of a state. And it also has the name of the contact person and contact information for that state. So anyone at a community, city, county, any level in a state, I think that without doing self-promotion, that those are really good snapshots of health disparities activities within a state that are funded by the state and other people as well.
I have a multi-part answer. Probably the first part would be to do your own self-assessment. What is it you're understanding? What do you know already? What's already within your authority to affect? Do you have access to funds? Or do you have access to resources or to data that could be used to actually make a difference? Second, begin expanding your circles. Who else in your county, in your city, in your state, in your region, and nationally is already addressing this? And how can you partner with them? We're not all alone, apparently. We have friends. So we should be able to, no matter who you are, particularly if you've got internet access, there's almost no excuse not to be able to find out what's already in play and how you can assist and provide input. And then probably the third thing is open your mouth and speak to the individuals who have a higher authority than you, who do have access to money, who can make policy, who can create laws. Because if they don't hear from you, they assume it's not a big deal. And I want to just assure people who are listening and watching this broadcast that when they actually are writing their letters to their state legislators and members of Congress and other state and federal officials, those letters actually do get read and they get counted. So that means unless somebody actually says something, there's nothing that registers. You have to say something. I can't tell you how many visits I've had from diabetes associations and heart associations and cancer associations. And those folks are out there advocating on behalf of the people who are impacted by those disease states. The individuals who understand the need to resolve, not address, resolve health disparities, need to speak up at that same level of passion and advocacy and not just try to put their head down to work. You got to do that, but you got to look up and raise your voice and say that it's not acceptable, that you want a law passed, you want the data to be reported, you want it to be acted on, and you don't want to accept it for the next generation going forward.
Well, that's great. So before we close, I'd like to thank Cheryl Boyce, Dr. Rhonda Meadows, and Dr. Brian Smedley for joining me today. And I would like to thank all of you for your questions. I apologize for all of the people we did not get to answer your questions. We had so many come in today. On our website, you will find resources about today's topic that may be useful to you. Again, I'm Kara James of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you.